about just now.
All right, so just throwing this out before we begin, Eirik Helfis is going to hopefully call in next time. We'll Skype him in. So if anyone knows the Jewish Center Wi-Fi password, send that my way. I'll try to get in touch with the powers that be to grab that password. I'll ask the powers that be.
Yeah, what happened? Flash shrank?
Yeah, what is it?
Well, the table shrank, that's for sure.
Maybe someone told us something we don't know.
Well, I know a couple people emailed me to let me know they're going to be in a little bit later. But we'll get started without them. They know we're going to get started. Okay. This class actually is my one of my the favorites of the ones that I've prepared. I've been really excited to get to this topic. Everything we've been doing is sort of a preamble for this, kind of like the one that we did on the Pharisees last two semesters ago. We can really pick up kind of exactly where we left off last time, and that is with synagogue floors, which is to say, just to very briefly review what we did last time, really in a couple of sentences. We came in with the assumption that all figurative art, all images, would have been prohibited by the Second Commandment, by the Dibur Hasheni. And if that's the case, then how come we find so much figurative art in shuls from the earliest period that we can find them, that we can find synagogue art, all the way through late antiquity, really into the modern period? It's a question that posts can deal with. Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva on this, of Herzog as a tshuva on this. There are lots of, it's very much a live issue. And the answer that we gave is that, at least until the Babylonian Talmud, all of our sources from our simple readings of Tanakh, all the way down to Josephus and then the rabbis, essentially expresses the notion that the way that the Second Commandment is to be interpreted is as prohibiting the worship of graven images rather than the production of graven images per se. And so, at least from a global biblical interpretation standpoint, which is something that Jews, whether they identified as part of the rabbinic class or otherwise, would have held in common. And therefore, we can explain things, we can explain the synagogue floors on sort of a what we've been calling for the last few semesters, a common Judaism or a complex common Judaism standpoint. The question that I'd like to get to this evening is, first of all, do we need to ask the same question about the rabbis and their presence in shuls? And if so, what would the answer be? So in other words, given what we did last week, we saw that this could take a whole very ugly turn. So given what we saw last week, we essentially can leave rabbis out of it. In other words, we saw last time that our evidence from rabbinic sources other than the Babylonian Talmud yields the conclusion that the rabbis held in common with everybody else that figurative art is permissible as long as you're not worshipping it. And in fact, the Second Commandment doesn't cover figurative art that's not being worshipped. However, there's no reason ab initio to assume that rabbis would have been in any of the synagogues that we looked at. We could say that rabbis, like everybody else, wouldn't have had a problem with this artwork. But we could also say, well, maybe we should retroject the conclusions of the Babli back onto the earlier material, assume that maybe the rabbis would have had an extra special problem with graven images, even if they're not being worshipped. Maybe it was some sort of gezeira that's implicit. There's no reason to, in other words, we could just as easily assume that rabbis would have avoided synagogues that had figurative art on the bottom, or that people who associated themselves with rabbis would have avoided synagogues with figurative art. And the ones that we saw were either anomalies or perhaps represented the interests of those who dissociated themselves from the rabbis, and maybe that's going to have to lead us to ask the question which we're going to tackle next class and the class after that. Maybe the rabbis were not as important a group in late antiquity as we might have assumed. Maybe they're even a very marginal group. Those are questions that we're going to have to ask given the evidence. And we're going to have to examine those questions thoroughly, and I think come to what I hope are more nuanced conclusions than either a yes or no answer. But today, this evening, what I'd like to do is take a look at a particular synagogue that's going to actually force us to really engage the question of how would a person who identifies either as a rabbi or identifies with the rabbis felt in a shul that has some of the artwork that we've identified so far. We're really going to actually be forced to ask that question by the sources that we're going to confront this evening. So with that preamble, let's take a look at the source sheet. So normally I give you a little piece of artwork at the top, at least if I have room. I like to keep the source sheets to this one page. But I usually give you a little bit of artwork at the top because I know as a consumer of source sheets, I like to have something to look at. In this particular case, I've tried to make this artwork ergonomically useful. So without further ado, take a look at the very top picture, which I've labeled Sefer Synagogue Mosaic, late 5th, early 6th century CE. And I want to identify first what we're looking at here. We saw last week a shul floor which had a zodiac and in the corners, north, south, east, and west, or wherever the corners are oriented, we saw representations of the four seasons, or what we probably would call, and as we'll see in this case, we actually do call in Hebrew the tkufot. And smack in the middle of it was a really very straightforward anthropomorphic depiction of the god Helios. I want to quickly make one correction from last week. I identified Helios with Apollo, the Greek god Apollo. That's not strictly speaking accurate, and I went back and listened, and that's not strictly speaking accurate. Apollo is strictly speaking the god of light. Helios is the personification of the sun. Egyptians have a very similar distinction between Ra as the god of light, the god of the sun, and Aten, which is the personification of the disk of the sun itself. In ancient Latin religion, they have a similar distinction, and the god of the sun is the god Sol, who ends up becoming identified with Helios. We're going to see a little bit more of Sol Invictus, Sol the Unconquerable, as we move along here. But Helios is not Apollo per se. They become sort of conflated a little bit in later sources, but Helios is really just the sun disk personified. Why I'm telling you this will become apparent as we move on to side number two of the source sheet. Okay, now, let's try to identify what it is that we're looking at in this picture here. This is from the center of another zodiac circle. It's from the floor of a synagogue in Tzipori. If anyone has a chance to go there, it's one of the most beautiful, interesting places.
The mosaics?
It's very possible. It sounds like something that would happen.
Yeah.
I'm not aware that that's the case for Sepphoris, for Tzipori, but it could very well be. Tzipori is a fascinating city. We're going to have occasion to talk about it in one of the later classes. It's real. So it's in the Galil. It's a major metropolis. There are rabbis located there. There are synagogues located there. There are pagans there. There are Christians there. It's just a bustling metropolis, not unlike our beloved Upper West Side. And one of the major finds there is there's a shul, right? So one of the shuls in Sepphoris that we can identify in Tzipori is this synagogue. On the floor, there's just a wealth of imagery there. First of all, there are dedicatory plaques. So-and-so should be remembered for the good, for his contribution, and so on and so forth. Then, like we saw last time, there's artwork. We're going to take a look at one of the more, I suppose, expected pieces of artwork, which has biblical themes, as we'll see below. But here, at the very center of one of the main panels of the floor, is this image. It's right in the middle of a zodiac wheel, right? So for space considerations, I can show you the whole wheel.
It's chariot of the sun, but the sun is a disc as opposed to a...
Right, so let's identify everything that's in this photo. So you correctly identify right in the middle there, that's obviously a sun, that golden disc at the very top there, right?
And a chariot.
And he's on a chariot, right? Those are horses that are
wheels,
pulling it.
The wheels
are on the
bottom.
The chariot took out the sun every day.
Ah, right.
And there's also the moon.
Right, there's a moon, right? There are the luminaries. There looks like...
The
right, there's a star in the corner there. Right, so those are horses. It's pulling a chariot. The chariot's holding the sun. The moon and the stars are trailing behind it. What is the chariot coming out of? It's a little bit difficult to identify. But look.
Water.
Excellent. Right, water. It's coming out of the water.
The parting of the seas.
So it's not the parting of the seas. We're going to see a little bit later what that imagery implies. But yes, he's coming out of the water. Right. So here, what we have in the very middle of the synagogue floor is something interesting. Mrs. Falk noted that it's not personified, it's just a drawing of the sun. This is certainly a representation of the god Helios. It just doesn't have an anthropomorphic representation. But this is the sun disk being pulled in its chariot out of the water. Classic Helios imagery. That's what this is meant to represent. It's meant to be Helios again. So this is another Helios in the middle of a shul. Right now, why am I showing you this? I just showed you a Helios mosaic last week. What's so special about this one? So take a look at source number one. Source number one, this is the panel. I've labeled these A, B, C, and D here and within source number one. Take a look at 1A. So here in 1A is the panel right to the right in the top left corner adjoining the zodiac. Now let's try to identify the things that we can see here. There's actually Hebrew writing that labels everything, so we can try and figure out what's going on. So what sort of pictures do we have in this panel here? There's a trumpet. There's an animal. It's a quadruped, right? It could be a wolf. It could be a fox. It's a quadruped, right? So let's leave that alone for a moment. What's to the right of that?
A cauldron.
A cauldron, a pot. It's a container of something. Ah, Mrs. Falk is correct. It's labeled that final nun. That's how the final nun is represented in these mosaics. It says shemen, right? So now we know what's in the jug, right? It's a container that has oil in it. What about below that?
Looks like a storehouse.
Looks like a storehouse, right? There's something. It looks like a house. What? In other words, can anyone read what the label is to the top right of that? Right. If we were reading it as an English word, it would be salt. Right, so it's not salt, but that actually is a fair hint about what it is. Right, it's a heap of something in a container. Right, so let's leave that alone for now. Take a look at before we identify positively what everything is in that panel. Take a look at source 1B. This is a pasuk in Sefer Bamidbar, and it reads as follows: What sacrifice are we talking about? Excellent. Right. Sally's correct. It's the tamid shel shacharis and the tamid shel arvis shel bein harabayim. Right. It's the daily offering that we bring once in the morning, once in the evening. It consists of a lamb. Right. One lamb in the morning, one lamb in the evening. Va'asiris ha'ifa soles lemincha belula b'shemen kasis revi'i sahin. Then how do you bring this carbon? So the one lamb you shall offer in the morning, the other at dusk, and the tenth part of an ephah of fine flour for a meal offering, mingled with the fourth part of a hin of beaten oil. It's a continual burnt offering. Excellent. Right, now we know exactly what's in this panel. What is that word on to the top right of the heap of something? Solet, right? It's solus, right? That's flour. Atop that, as we can now figure out, is of course shemen. To the left. Now what is that thing to the left of the shemen? Well, not to the left of the solus, to the left of the shemen, to the left of the oil. That quadruped, that animal, it's a lamb, right? Now, how do we know it's a lamb? So take a look. If you look right above the lamb, you can see the words starting over here: ve'es hakeves hasheni. Right? That's in the panel just above that, there's the keves ha'achad. This is the keves ha'sheni. This is the tamid. This is the evening daily offering. So now, basically all of the components except the wine, all of the components of the carbon tamid are in this panel. There's one thing that doesn't seem to fit here based on the psukim that we just read, and that is the chatzotzers, right? Why are the trumpets here? What are they doing here? So take a look. Take a look at source 1C. This is another pasuk. This is from Parshas Bahalosra. The pasuk says as follows. It's talking about all the different times that we blow on the chatzotzros, that we blow on the trumpets. V'yom simchaschem v'ma'adechem v'rashecha tshechem uskatem chatzotzros ala losechem v'al zivchei shalmechem v'ayu lachem lezikaron lefnei elokechem ani Hashem elokechem. When do you blow on the chatzotzros? So the balosa lays it out, times of war. Also in the day of your gladness and in your appointed seasons and in your new moons, you shall blow with the trumpets over your burnt offerings, over the sacrifices of your peace offerings, and they shall be to you for a memorial before your God. I am the Lord your God. So now we know all of the times that according to the simple reading of the pasuk, we blow the chatzotzros. Rosh Chodesh, holidays, times of gladness, right? When you eat sacrificial meat on holidays, Over certain types of fully burnt karbanos, over certain types of peace offerings, of shlamim that you consume. Those are the times you blow the chatzotzer. So what is not mentioned here? Exactly, right, the carbon tamid. The carbon tamid is not here, right? That's very clearly not one of the times that you blow the chatzotzeros, at least according to the simple reading of this pasuk. Now, take a look at source 1D, Sifrei Zuta. Now, then there's no reason, of course, to assume that you would blow the trumpets for the daily offering, because there's no indication that that would ever be the case. However, one of the very, very early midrashei halacha, one of the very early legal midrashim, the Sifrei Zuta, Sifrei Zuta tells us, Ma'adechem, and the Sifrei Zuta, for those who are interested, it emanates from, most likely, from the school of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Akiva's students. It's a very interesting text. It has a lot of Tanaim that are only named in Sifrei Zuta, not named elsewhere. It's a very old text, and it's very fascinating. And it also has a lot of halachos that we don't find record of elsewhere in rabbinic literature. And Sifrei Zuta tells us, Ma'adechem, Elu Hatamidim. The word moadechem in the pasuk that we just read on your appointed seasons, which normally we would take, a moed is normally understood to be a holiday, a chag, right? So what does umoadechem mean at your appointed times? It means for the karban tamid. You blow the chatzotzos every day accompanying the daily offering. So the notion that a karban tamid is accompanied by the blowing of trumpets, clearly, I mean, we don't have any other source for this, seems to originate with rabbinic literature. So now we have the floor. Now, what's the upshot of all of this? We have a floor of a synagogue, and there are a couple of other examples from this synagogue floor. Another one in the panel, two to the right of this panel that you're looking at here. If you go online, you can find it. Has a depiction of Bikurim, and the basket of Bikurim has two birds hanging off the side of it. That's straight out of a Mishnah in Bikurim, and the Yerushalmi clarifies that the birds can't be on top, they have to be on the sides of the basket, just as they are in the mosaic floor. So the impact of rabbinic literature is clearly felt on the floor of this mosaic. Here is a mosaic that has a depiction of the daily offering, complete with the chatzotzeros, the source for which accompanying the daily offering is only in rabbinic literature. So now we're confronted with the problem we're really confronted with the task of addressing the fact that here we have a synagogue floor that clearly is commissioned by either rabbis or probably more likely people who associate with rabbis. And at the very center of it, the planning committee stuck a Helios imagery, stuck a sun disk imagery, which, whether or not it violates the second commandment, is a picture of an idol. In other words, is a picture of a foreign god. So we certainly have to explain this. Now, before we get into the explanation, I should preface this as follows. If anyone's encountered any of the scholarly literature on the synagogue, the nature of the synagogue, who is in the synagogue, or if anyone's just heard anyone discuss in the ancient synagogues, there's a tendency to try and figure out whether shuls, as such, are rabbinic shuls or non-rabbinic shuls. Did rabbis have control over shuls, or did they not have control over a given shul? I think all of this is mostly a red herring. Take the Jewish Center, for example. If this shul were to be completely depopulated, covered by dust and dug up by archaeologists 2,000 years from now, and the archaeologists had before them all of rabbinic literature and the remains of the shul, there's no possible way anyone could identify this shul as a shul that had a rabbi. There's nothing rabbinic about any of the imagery in this shul. Right. Assuming the plaques. Even the plaques. So the plaque, at least the one on the right that I look at because I'm in that row, it's dedicated to Dr. Norman Lamb. So I can imagine.
There's a medical center.
I can imagine.
The other one is Dr.
I think it's also right, Doctor. No, it's Rabbi Dr. Leo. It is Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. So let's assume that the ravages of time took away the Rabbi Young plaque, and all that was left was the Dr. Lamb plaque. So I can imagine some enterprising young academic making the case that, well, this was a doctor shul. There were rabbi shuls, and there are doctor shuls. So, and I, the shul in which I grew up, the Ingersoll West Ham, said there's nothing that would identify it as a rabbinic shul per se. So the fact that we can actually identify this shul as what I think with very high degree of likelihood, a rabbinic shul is just... a nes min hashamayim. I mean, it's really something that we're fortunate to be able to do. It's the odds of this happening are minuscule, so we should count ourselves lucky that we can even ask this question. But that said, the question now stands before us. Why would a shul that cares enough to infuse the artwork on its floor with rabbinic interpretations of halacha also at the very same time have in the very middle of the floor, and by far the most magnificent part of the floor, have this depiction of a Greco-Roman sun god? It's just, at first glance, completely unfathomable. Now, that brings us to the larger question of the sun. Now, what do I mean? Take a look at source number two. I think the beginning of our answer, and I'd like to work through this together, is going to derive from the fact that the sun, as such, is a long-standing thorn in the side of Jewish theology that long predates the floor of the synagogue in Tzipori. That is to say, this is not the first time that Judaism and Jewish thought and Jewish literature, Jewish practice, Jewish artwork, as we'll see in a moment, has had to confront the existence and seeming power of the sun. Take a look at source number two. Source number two is on the left-hand side, is from a place called Kuntilet Ashrud. Kuntilet Ashrud is about halfway between, or it's at least on the way, from, if you're going from Eilat, right, if you're a caravan, and you have goods to bring, and you're in Eilat, and you are compelled to travel all the way to Gaza. You want to sell your wares to the northwest. So you travel. You can travel up the mainland and then make a left, or you can go straight on a diagonal between Eilat and Gaza. And the way that you're gonna get there, it's about a day and a half journey by caravan. So the way that you're gonna get there, maybe a little longer. The way that you're gonna get there is you're gonna stop on the way at this place called Kuntilet Ashrud. Kuntilet Ashrud is a caravan rest stop, and we are fortunate to have recovered from Kuntilet Ashrud a number of really fascinating pieces of artwork and some inscriptions. Probably the oldest physical evidence of Hebrew poetry comes from Kuntilet Ashrud. Of course, we have very old Hebrew poetry, Az Yashir and so Shiras Devorah, but those things survive in manuscripts that are far later than the texts or the events that they describe. The oldest physical bit of evidence that we can hold in our hands and say, here is Hebrew poetry, is from Kuntilet Ashrud. It's not a biblical poem, but it is Hebrew poetry that refers, I think, refers to Har Sinai in literary, with literary allusions. Really fascinating place. Now, one of the really fascinating and also distressing things to come out of Kuntilet Ashrud is that Kuntilet Ashrud provides us with some of the clearest and most incontrovertible evidence, aside from Tanakh, that Jews in, and maybe we should call them Jews in the sense of being from Judea, Israelites as well, if you came from the north, were of the Avodah Zarah. It's a sad thing, but it is the case. Some of the things that come out of Kuntilet Ashrud are references to HaKadosh Baruch Hu using the Shem Havaya, referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as being a local god of a certain place, like, for instance, Teiman, or Shomron, and so on and so forth. And the, at least potentially, although I don't think this is the best interpretation, the idea that that Yud Kei Vav Kei is one among at least two gods. Hopefully we'll have time in a different semester to discuss these finds from Kuntilet Ashrud. But one of the ones that I think is relevant to us is I've given you over here. This is from the side of a pithos. A pithos is like a wine jug, or really any type of jug. And this is sort of one of the crude drawings that you find on here. Now, I'd like to analyze this and try and figure out what this is a depiction of. We're going to assume for a moment that, and you'll see why I say this in a second, that this little circle up top here, although I actually think that it's deliberate, that little circle up there, let's assume that little circle is a mistake. But leaving that for the moment, so what are we looking at here? So what is this a picture of? People. How many? Five people. Now, if you, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, potentially 6 if that little circle up there is supposed to be the beginning of a person. Or if that's supposed to be a head, then maybe 6. Now, what you'll notice, right, it might be a mother and child. Right, that's certainly possibly true. It could be that little circle could be the sun. That's what I think that it is. But even if it's not, but I think that it is.
Those are the rays, the two things coming.
Right, it could be rays. What I want you to do is take a look at the eyes, even if it's not the sun. Take a look at the eyes of these figures. If you'll notice, if we start from the right side, now the one all the way on the right doesn't have eyes. It's not a very sophisticated artist. But if you start from the one farthest on the right that has eyes, you'll notice that the eyes are looking pretty much at eye level. And the eyes are sort of in the part of the head where you would expect eyes to be if you're looking forward. As you go progressively to the left, you'll notice that the eyes creep further and further up the forehead. I don't know if you can see that. Till you get to the one all the way on the left, the eye is basically positioned at the top of the head. And the head is drawn sort of on a slant. It looks like it's looking up. So, if we had to figure... Now, what else are they doing? What else is significant about all these figures? How are they positioned? Their hands are in beseeching position, right? They're raising their hands up to their faces. And they seem to be... Each one seems to be looking at a fixed point in the sky. Now, if that circle is a sun or a moon or something like that, that would be even better. But even if it's not, and I think that it is, I think that it's the sun, but even if it's not, take a look at the pasuk in Eov to the right of this. So in Eov, one of the things that the Sefer warns about with respect to idolatry is the following. Im er'eh or ki yahel v'yareach yakar holech v'yift baseser libi v'tishak yadi lefi gam hu avon pulili ki chichashti lakel mima'al. If I beheld the sun when it shined, or the moon walking in brightness, and my heart has been secretly enticed, and my mouth has kissed my hand, that's essentially, you raise your hand up all the way up to your face. This also were a judicial offense, for I would have lied to God that is above, or maybe I would have contradicted God that is above. One of the things that Eov warns about is precisely this position. People, Jews, standing, looking at the sun, raising their hands to their face, and praying to the sun. So here we have, depending on when Eov dates to, which is hard to figure out, but we have evidence from a pretty early period, Kuntelet Ashrud, and from Eov, that there are Jews who are worshipping the sun, and that this is a problem that Tanakh feels it has to deal with. Even more explicit, take a look at the next source, the next page, from Yechezkel. Right, that's true. That's true. That is also true. And you'll also notice they don't have long beards. Long beards were what Assyrians had. Assyrians had nice long rabbinic beards. Jews usually had their beards close cropped. Yechezkel tells us the following. Vayaveosi el chatzar beis Hashem apinimis. Right, Yechezkel is describing the vision that he has of God showing him the temple and how full it is with despicable people. Vehine pesach echal Hashem bein haulam bein hamizbeach esrim v'chamisha ish achareihem el echal Hashem ufneim kedma vehema mishtachavim kedma lashamesh. And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, and they worshipped the sun toward the east. This is explicit. Yechezkel is telling us that one of the problems that he confronts is in the Beis HaMikdash itself. There are people who are worshipping the sun and doing it in the context of worshipping God. Yes?
Why are they so into this? I remember, was it 5 years ago, 6 years ago? Comes every 28 years.
A Birkas HaChama.
Right. I was,
we're going to get to that in a moment.
Yeshiva HaKotel, 28 years before that, I was on a tablet. The World Trade Center, I was a show. I mean, viewing it. And in Yeshiva HaKotel, both chief rabbis were there.
Right, right.
I mean, really.
Yeah, so there's something.
I mean, that it's not so political. So we're,
the idea of really involving the sun, right? Kiddush Levana. So Birkas, we're actually going to get to, save that, it's an excellent question, we're going to get to Birkas HaChama in Source 4. So now, And for those who aren't familiar with Birkas HaChama, we'll catch up to speed when we get to source number four. So here, what clearly emerges from these biblical sources is the fact that of the problems that the Jews are encountering, one of the very serious ones is sun worship, solar worship. Now, among the very problematic sun gods of the ancient Near East that Tanakh confronts, so the major ones are Ra, right? Ra is in Egypt. Aten, right, is the sun disk of Egypt. Those are big ones. Really the most important god, because Tanakh, or Chumash at least, goes out of its way to polemicize against it, is the god Shamash. What word sounds like Shamash that we use? Shemesh, right? One of the things that is really fascinating about the very beginning of Chumash is how it actually names in Bereishis, in the very beginning of Bereishis, many foreign gods, and or gods that were operative in the ancient Near East, especially in Canaan, in the northwest Semitic area, and it depersonalizes them. It completely strips them of all
power.
Divine qualities. Some famous examples are Mot, right, the god of death, Yam, one of the sea gods, Shamash is the sun god, and so on and so forth. These are all important gods. What Chumash does is Chumash strips them of their divine character and uses them simply as names for geographical features. It completely depersonalizes them in that sense, doesn't even acknowledge their existence. Shamash is one of those gods, the sun god, the warrior god. Now, here's the question. If it's true that Helios is not the first time, the Greco-Roman sun god, is not the first time that Jews have encountered a foreign god of the sun, right? The solar worship confronting a god of the sun was already a problem in the times of Chumash and the times of Tanakh. So, are there any resources that we can identify in the biblical period for confronting the challenge of Jews worshiping the sun? We can see from Yechezkel that it was an obvious problem. People would stand brazenly, without any shame, in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash itself, and they would worship the sun. There's no shame involved. So, can we imagine a polemical response, some sort of engaged theological response to the notion of sun worship, to the power of the sun, to the idea that the sun is a... clearly an imminently felt influence in the life of basically every person, right? The sun shines upon us all. The answer is, I think that we can. Let's take a look at source number three. This is something that this is a mizmor of Tehillim that we say, that we recite every single Shabbos. And it says as follows. This is from Tehillim Mizmor Yates. And it says the following. Now what we're going to do is read this very closely. We're going to identify, first of all, the manner in which it describes the heavens, and then we're also going to try and identify some of the other themes that emerge from this mizmar, and attempt to figure out what exactly is the literary rhetorical strategy of this psalm. So take a look. Shamayim mesaprim kavod kel, masei adav magid arakia, yom liyom yabia omer, v'layla l'layla yechav adas, ein omer v'ein devarim b'li nishma kolam, Mechol ha'aretz yatzak kavam v'ksei sevel milehem la'shemesh sam oa bahem v'hu kachasan yotzei mechupaso yasis ki gibor la'aretz orach mikzei ha'shamayim otzao uskufaso al kitzosam v'ein nestar mechamaso toraz Hashem timima meshivas navesh edus Hashem ne'amana machkimas pesi. Okay. The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of His hands, day to day pours forth speech, in other words, each day speaks to the next day. Night to night reveals knowledge, right? Each night reveals the knowledge of what just transpired, or the knowledge of God to the next night. But this speech and this knowledge, it's not speech and they are not words. Their voice is unheard, right? It's silent. Yet, their sound, right? The sound that the days and the nights make go out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. Among them, among the Shamayim, among the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It emerges from the edge of the heavens, and its circuit is across its boundaries, and nothing is concealed from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. Okay. What two themes emerge from the selection that I've given you? And these are the two themes that are present in the Mizmor. I haven't given you the rest of the Mizmor because it goes on in the same vein. What are the two themes that emerge here? What are the two subjects of the Baal HaMizmor's praise?
The Lord provides the constancy of the sun.
Right. So in other words, God, and we'll come back to this in a moment. God lies behind all of this. But in particular, what are the two things what are the two things to which this psalm is appealing? What are the two things that receive the adoration or the admiration of the psalmist?
The heavenly bodies.
Right? Well, so one is the heavenly bodies, right? And in particular,
the sun.
And what else?
Also, all the Devarim, like that the Kalam and the Bar, and so that all of these creations speak.
Right, that's.
Speak to the Creator.
I actually want to pick up on that, right? So, in other words, speech and the idea that common to all of the universal bodies is some sort of language. Actually leads us to the next thing that the Mizmor talks about. What's the last thing that's mentioned in the Mizmor?
That the laws of the...
Right.
Torah
es Hashem Temima. Right? The law of God is perfect. Right, so the two things that come in for praise in this Mizmor are the sun and Torah. Right, and the law. The content of what it is that we adore, the content of what it is that we receive from HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
Are we talking about natural law?
Yeah, I thought it was natural law. I thought it was the constancy of the circulation of the sun and the heat and the light.
Right, so I think...
So that is
one way to read it, but if you actually look at, so first of all, you can tell from the end of this pasuk that there's a hint that we're actually dealing with something with intellectual substance, and the rest of the Mizmor makes it clear as well that what is this Torah? It's machkimas pesi. It makes wise the simple. The idea of something being machkim, of providing chachma, right? So of making somebody wise, of improving somebody. So I don't think that fits as well the natural law or sort of the laws of physics characterization. I think it fits more something like the content of Chumash or what have you, right? The idea that this Torah is machkim, it shows that the subject here is not natural, is not sort of the natural bodies. I think it's something with intellectual content.
I mean, there's a whole concept in Judaism, Torah or like the Torah is life.
Right.
That's an excellent point.
I want to pick up on that for a second, actually, right? So the idea of Torah or the idea of mixing these metaphors, right? The sun and the law, of mixing them together, that I think derives actually directly from this Mizmor. And here's why it's significant. This Mizmor is, first of all, astonishing for the amount of praise it lavishes upon something that, perhaps even at the time that this Mizmor was composed, was actively being worshipped by Jewish people. The sun. And it uses the name that, although obviously not with that intent, but it uses the name of the God, right? La Shemesh, Sam Oel Bahem, right? For the Shemesh, for the sun, a tent is placed in the heavens, right? So it uses the name of, now, anyone who was reading this would have heard, at the time, would have heard Shemesh, would have heard Shemash, they would have heard the sun god. Now, what does this Mizmor do with the sun? Right, so the sun. First of all, it compares the sun to a bridegroom, right? To a gibor, right? To a champion, to a brave person.
It's displaying the rest of the world. Right? It's traveling the circuit of the world, and it's also shining light. Nothing is hidden from. So it's revealing everything else. Nothing else can hide from its light.
Excellent.
But it's revealing everything else.
Right, so in other words, right, it really is striking language. In other words, nothing can hide from the sun.
Just some reflection of God. Are they trying to, is that what this is about?
Right, so here's the question is, here's the question, and that Dr. Schwartzbaum, I think, is raising. In what way is the sun placed in proportion to God in this Mizmor? So what's the answer?
It's like a servant declares
the... How do you know? Exactly. The Shemayim is Mesaprim Kavod Kel, right? The the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sun, for all that, ein nistar mechamaso, that no one can hide from its heat, who put the sun where it is and made sure that it travels in its tkufa, it travels its circuit around the heavens? Lashemesh sam oel bahem. Who is the one who places the tent in the heavens for the sun? Who builds a house for the sun and keeps it there until he wants it there? God. God is the one who puts it there, number one. And number two, what's the other perfect thing that God created? In Pasuk Ches, the Torah, or his law. Right? Whether that's Torah with a capital T or not, the fact of the matter is that what the Mizmar does is it really brilliantly juxtaposes two themes here. On the one hand, you have the sun. And the Ein Nistar Mechamaso, no human being can hide from the rays of the sun. It's like a bridegroom running out. It traverses the heavens. Everybody can see it. But God created it, and God created something else equally mighty, equally perfect, and equally worthy of admiration, and that is his law, his word. So what the Mizmar does is, first of all, it subverts the idea of a sun god, right? God is the one who's really responsible for the sun, and the sun doesn't do anything without God. And two, God has created other things that are of equal importance, and those things, the world of Torah is just as important as the world of nature, and it's a really brilliant juxtaposition here. In fact, I only put this one example below this because I ran out of room on the source sheet, but the Mizmor here is shot through with language that alludes to very explicit and very popular traditions about Shamash himself, about the sun god of the ancient Near East. One of them, there's a long hymn to Shamash. It's actually very old. It may even begin in two or 3,000 years before this Mizmor is composed. It comes to its final form right at the end of the second millennium. So, maybe a little bit after Yetzias Mitzrayim, the beginning of maybe during the time of the judges. And it says as follows. Here it's talking about Shamash. Regularly and without cease, you traverse the heavens. Every day you pass over the broad earth, right? Part of what makes Shamash praiseworthy is precisely b'chol aretz is rather miksei shamayim motzaos kuvasol kutzosam, the circuits of the earth that Shamash makes. Now, in the hymn to Shamash, Shamash is the one who decides where he wants to go. He goes everywhere that he wants. In the Mizmar, it's God who decides where the sun wants to go. One of the famous epithets, whenever you see the name Shamash, you're always going to see this epithet. Shamash is always Shamash, hero, warrior. Shamash is a warrior god. Shamash is a hero god. Shamash is a mighty god. Unlike other gods who are given other epithets, Shamash is always a mighty god. What's the name that's given to what's the one thing to which or one of two things to which the sun is compared in this Mizmor? Yosis Kegibor, Larutz Orach, right? The sun is like a mighty person ready to run a sprint. Now, of course, the mighty person is, first of all, Yasis, rejoicing at being able to do God's bidding. The sun here is ever and always God's servant. So here, already in the period of Tanakh, there's a brilliant, literarily sophisticated antidote, if you will, to sun worship. This is the response to sun worship. The sun may be important, but first of all, it's not the only important thing in our lives. And second of all, the sun exists to do the bidding of God. If you want to personify the sun, so instead of opting for Shamash, instead of opting for the Near Eastern sun god, we can opt for the Shemesh as a servant of God. So the idea that the sun can be personified, right? The idea that the sun can be spoken of in human terms, like a bridegroom or like a mighty person. So that is something that Shamash imagery would have done, but it's something that Tehillim does as well, but it subverts it. You can personify it, but ultimately, even if you're going to personify it, the sun is a servant of God. So here, already in the biblical period, what we have is a strategy rooted in the 19th chapter of Psalms, for dealing with personifications of the sun and worship of the sun. And that is to say, the sun personified is merely a servant of God, and it's one magnificent creation among many. With that in hand, take a look at the sources in group number four. I want to come back now to something Mr. Deegan asked about before. Mr. Deegan asked before, don't we have all these traditions about keeping track of the sun, giving the sun special importance. We all gathered on the beaches. On the beaches, when was it now? 2 years ago? 2 years ago? A year ago? 3 years ago?
No, it was several years ago.
Several years ago, we all gathered on the beach to recite Birkas Hachama. Why did we recite Birkas Hachama? Why did we recite the blessing over the sun? Where was the sun? So the sun was as we learned when we learned about Birkas Hachama. The sun was in precisely the position that it was when it was created. That tradition derives from the Babylonian Talmud. That's the way that the Babylonian Talmud interprets a blessing that is prescribed in rabbinic literature, even earlier rabbinic literature, that one recites over the sun. How the Bavli gets to that interpretation, why the Bavli does that, is something we're not going to have time to deal with now. What we're going to do is look at one of the earlier texts, which is preserved in the Yerushalmi, in the Jerusalem Talmud, and also in Vayikra Rabbah, in Leviticus Rabbah, one of the early Midrashim on Vayikra, which has a different interpretation of what blessing we're supposed to recite upon the sun. And it says as follows. Although this is, of course, the Talmud Bavli is interpreting this source. Here's what we have in the Yerushalmi. Haroa es achama bit kufasa, ves alavana bit kufasa, ves arakia bit tiharo, omer baruch ose bereshis. Now, leaving aside how the Bavli gets to the interpretation of this source that it does, we can note really two things. Number one, what's the law that we have here? Any person who sees the sun in its tekufa, whatever that means, or who sees the moon in a similar situation, or he sees the sky in its purity, so you recite, blessed is the one who brings about creation. Now, there are two key words here that should make us think back to the 19th chapter of Psalms. And what are those two words? So what, yeah, well, for number one is tekufa. Sally's correct. Where do we see tekufa? In Mizmor Yates, right? Tekufa so al kesosam, right? When you see the sun in its making its circuit around the sky, that is one of the ein nistar mechamasa. So that's one of the time when nobody can hide from this glorious servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What's the other word? What's the word that the Yerushalmi here uses for the sun? Chama. So that's the normal rabbinic word for the sun. However, in the presence of the word tekufa, so what comes right after the word tekufa in Tehillim? Uskufa so al ketzosam, ve'ein nistar mechamaso. Can hide from the heat of the sun. Right here, the word for sun, unlike earlier in the Mizmor, which is Shemesh, here it's chama, right? The heat of the sun. So haroa es achama betekufasa. Anybody who sees the sun in the condition that is described by the 19th chapter of Tehillim, that's when you recite this bracha. And what's the bracha that you recite? Osev Bereishis. What does that bracha express? God creates things. What's one of the things that God creates? The sun. Why this bracha precisely on the sun?
So that God created it, as opposed
to and that is precisely the literary strategy that Mizmor Yates adopts. I mean, it's an incredible reading of Mizmor Yates by Chazal. Chazal intuit exactly what the 19th chapter of Psalms is supposed to be about, which is a divinely oriented polemic against the sun. And so Chazal understand that that's exactly the intention. And so when you see the sun in the literary condition that you find it in the 19th chapter of Psalms, you recite the bracha that acknowledges God as the creator of all things and as the supreme being. So here we have an early source that shows, and this is what I'd like to develop in the waning minutes here, that develops the notion that Chazal, rather than being the first Jews to confront the challenges of a sun god, Chazal actually are inheriting a long tradition of confronting the sun god. And not only are they inheriting the challenge of confronting the sun god, they're also inheriting the solutions that Jewish theology came up with, or that Jewish theological strategies came up with, to confront the sun god. My last bit of evidence, or second to last bit of evidence, take a look at the source right below that. We're gonna have to read this as close as we can in 1 or 2 minutes. This is from Bereishis Rabbah. Bereishis Rabbah is probably the earliest of the Midrash Rabbah collection. Bereishis Rabbah is the earliest of them. It's from about the end of the 4th, early 5th century. The end of Bereishis Rabbah, if you're ever studying Bereishis Rabbah carefully, is the end of Bereishis Rabbah, I think from beginning Pisgah Tzadihei and forward, it's from the Tanchuma, or at least it relies on something similar to the Tanchuma, it's a little bit later. The early parts of Bereishis Rabbah are pretty early. So here's what the source says. Gal golchama yeshlo noshtak matamei lashemesh tsam oal bohem ubrecha shalmayim lafanav. B'shoah sheyotze kadosh baruch hu matesh es kocho b'mayim shelo yotza v'yisrof es ha'olam. Aval la'asad lavo kadosh baruch hu ma'arta lo minoshtako u'malahato. Ma'atama u'liyahet osam ayom haba. Or rather, u'liyahet osam ayom haba. Rabbi Yanei Rav Shimon ben Lakish Omrin rather, ein gehinom el yom shemalahet esar ha'shoim. The sun, right, the sun disk, the globe of the sun, Gal Gal Chama, has a sheath, right? It's covered up. How do we know? Lashemesh sam oal bahem, right? Because God created a tent for the sun in the heavens. Where is this from, this pasuk? From above, correct, right? It's from Psalm 19. It's from the verse that we just cited. Now, what precisely does this sheath do? So first of all, where is the sun? So the sun has a sheath over it, and a lake of water stands before it. Right? So the sun emerges out of the water. Why does it emerge out of the water? Because when it goes forth, the Holy One, blessed be He, tempers its strength in the water, lest it go forth and burn up the world. Right? So the sun coming out of the water, what's the purpose of the sun coming up out of the water? Because what would the sun do otherwise? It'd burn everything. So what's the solution to the sun burning? Now, if the sun could burn everything, so the sun would unquestionably be the most powerful entity in the world. So what happens, according to the Midrash?
It tempers it with water.
Right. It gets diluted, and as Dr. Schwartzbaum says, who tempers it with water? God tempers it with water. And it's so much the case that God has control over the sun that in the future, the Lord will bear it from its sheath and burn it up. What is the proof? The day that comes shall set them ablaze. Rabbi Yana and Reish Lakish said, there is no other Gehenim, right? Gehenim is, according to some, is a place, right? Something akin to hell. According to many other sources in rabbinic literature, it's a time. Gehinom is the day which will burn up the wicked. So what is God going to do? So normally, now, nominally, God protects us from the sun by enclosing it in an ohel. In the future, God is going to unveil the sun in its full fury. And what is He going to do with it? He's going to burn things, destroy things, but as Mrs. Deegan says, He's going to burn the wicked people. Now, if it was really true that without the sheath that encloses the sun, that encases the sun, it could burn up the entire world, so what would we expect when the sheath is removed from the sun? What would it burn up?
Everything.
However, at the end of days, it's only going to burn up the Rishayim, according to Bereishis Rabbah, which indicates what?
Is that the sun that's different? That the people are different?
Right. In other words, the people have been altered into such a state where the sun is going to be required to discern between good people and wicked people. Now, is it the sun who discerns between good and evil in this scenario? The answer is no. As the Midrash says, that it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu ma'arta lo minishtako malahato. It's God who's going to remove the sheath, and then He's going to use the power of the sun to selectively burn up, to selectively punish those who require it. So the sun here is every inch the servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We don't have time to read this last source. The last source is rather late anyway. It's from long after the period that we're discussing. It's from the 8th century, 9th century. There may be later material. Pirkei d'Rabbi is rather late, even though it has some very early, weird pseudepigrapha material in it. But Pirkei d'Rabbi if you have time to look at it, you'll see that the very same themes of the sun being the servant of God and it using verses from Psalm 19 that we saw to prove that the sun is the servant of God and does God's bidding exclusively lasts for a very long time in Jewish literature. So Jewish theologians, Jewish thinkers, Jewish sages, from a very early period to a very late period, perpetuate this polemic against the sun and this idea and this manner of combating the sun, which is to say that the sun is truly a servant of God. Now, two things. First of all, this helps us explain the presence on the floor of what we can only call a rabbinic synagogue, in a sense that's even truer than what we're even used to in our shuls. The sun the presence of Helios in a rabbinic synagogue is now easily explicable, which is to say that Chazal and people in their circles and Jews across the spectrum of late antiquity would have been the heirs to hundreds of years, to centuries of having the idea inculcated into their thought that the sun, in whatever form it takes, anthropomorphic, a sun disk, a person, a bridegroom, a hero, the sun is nothing more than the servant of God. So the idea of Helios appearing in a synagogue, even one that has rabbis in it, shouldn't surprise us. The sun, after all, in whatever form it takes, is an Eved Hashem as much as anything else is a servant of God as much as anything else is. Now, the question that intrigues me, in 30 seconds that we have left, I'll address this, is why, first of all, in a general sense, is this class at all relevant to us? We've solved, I think, the riddle of, I think, an archaeological riddle. That's always a useful thing. We have knowledge that we didn't have before, for its own sake. Torah Lishma is always important. But as I was preparing this class, I felt very strongly that we should do something this evening with relevance to the terrible, astonishing, but in some cases not astonishing, events of the previous few days. And I think the relevance of this topic for the shootings at the magazine, the shootings at the kosher grocery store, is rather a simple one, but unfortunately one that we are forced as a people to learn again and again and again. And that is, this is not the first time in history that we've encountered the foe that faces us this day. Whether we look back 60 years to the Holocaust, whether we look back 600 years, give or take, to the Inquisition, whether we look back 900 years, give or take, to the Crusades, whether we look back 2,000 years to the Romans, whether we look back 3,000 years, 32,000 years to the Egyptians, this is not the first time we've faced this enemy. The enemy that sees Jews as guilty, as people who have been convicted of a crime, the crime being of being born a Jew, and all that means. The enemy that sees us as targets, as always and forever targets, is an enemy that we've faced many times before, and that makes it not less frightening, but far more frightening, because we are a people who are in many ways destined to fight this foe until HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and redeems us Meher B'Yameinu. On the one hand. And in that respect, I think we're very much the heirs of Chazal. Chazal were Avodah Zarah, idolatry, and all of the values that idolatry entails is spiritually corrosive in a way that many times throughout our history, especially the early eras of our history, wiped us out as a people. And Chazal, in confronting idolatry, in confronting images, confronting sun worship, confronting the fetishization of nature, and the erecting of altars to physics, as much as we use those things as indispensable and in some ways irrefutable tools, the idea of setting up science, physics, on a pedestal and worshiping it as the only truth that we have is something that we face to this day. So Chazal were not the first people to face that challenge. Chazal were not the first people to face the challenge of the sun, something that their ancestors had faced and their ancestors had faced. We're in very much the same boat, facing an old foe. On the other hand, Chazal, first of all, were well aware that they had within their tradition the resources to face up to those challenges. And not only did they parrot those resources, Chazal didn't just recite Mizmor Yates anytime they saw Helios, they transformed that tradition and made it their own and used it as an expression of the ongoing creativity that sustains us as a people. Birkas Hachama, the idea of reciting a blessing with respect to the sun, praising God for having created the sun, was not something that Mizmor Yates envisioned, but it's something that Chazal drew out of its authentic reading of Mizmor Yates. Chazal took a problem that was an age-old problem and a solution that was an age-old solution, and they created their own solutions out of it. And that drive to always be creative, even in the face of ancient enemies and ancient problems, is something that defined Chazal and should define us as a people, we who are their heirs. And on that note, I'd like to close by simply offering the bracha that we, as the heirs of Chazal, and the stewards of the rabbinic tradition in the modern age, should merit to the intellectual strength, courage, and ingenuity that our ancestors possessed in confronting old challenges with authentic but also creative and people-sustaining, life-sustaining solutions until HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees fit to send his Redeemer to us, Meher Bi'Ameinu. And with that, I wish you a good evening.